there's something undefinable that beckons travelers back to the greater Fort Myers area in southwest Florida year after year. It feels like bare feet on soft white sand beaches that give way to gently lapping waves. It looks like the breathtaking abundance of wildlife, colorful birds, dolphins, manatees, and more, dwelling in lush mangrove ecosystems and translucent Gulf waters. It tastes like fresh coastal cuisine served at sunset at a waterfront restaurant. What will draw you back to Fort Myers? Go to visitfortmyers.com for more inspiration.
Hey, everyone. It's Estelle Herndon, political reporter for The New York Times. When I became a journalist, I made a promise to my readers, like the way the doctors take an oath to their patients. I committed to bringing the truth to light, no matter which party, business, organization, or person I'm reporting on. I have to be persistent. I have to do research, and I have to push back when someone tries to hide or spin the facts. And I know I'm going to write stories that both Democrats and Republicans don't like. But that's what The New York Times has been doing for more than a century, and that's what we're going to keep doing. We believe the public deserves the right to make up their mind based on the facts. So if you want to support this kind of work, you can subscribe to The New York Times at nytimes.com/subscribe.
Queen Bee, want no smoke with me? Okay. And turn his mouth up 800 degrees.
Welcome to the New York Times podcast, your making of a maestro of music, news, and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
Talk big, but my bank account match it. Hood, but I'm classy. Rich, but I'm ratchet. Haters kept my name in their mouth.
It is foggy. It is dewy. I am underslept. You know what that means. It was Grammy night last night. Woo! 63rd Annual Grammy Awards. Low-key, kind of fun. As you know, if you've listened to many podcasts in the past, we love few things more than waking up the day after the Grammys, coming on podcast, and just pummeling. This year, however, it's a more complicated picture. So we are going to get into it. We're going to do two segments, two conversations this episode. First, Karen Gans, Joe Coscarelli, Ben Cesario, going to call in, talk about the major categories, news, big movements, etc. After that, John Perelis, Lindsay Zolads, we're going to have a little bit of a critic confab talking about the performances, down ballot winners, etc. It is an action-packed episode, so without further ado, let's kick it off. Karen Gans is here, fired up. Karen, hi.
Hi, John.
Karen, are you squeezing a stress ball right now?
I'm not, but I really wish I was. Feel free to FedEx one over.
Joe Coscarelli is here.
Yes.
Ben Cesario is here.
Hey.
Hey, Ben, so you did not have to fly to Los Angeles for the Grammys.
Yeah.
How did that feel to not have to do that?
Good in a way, sad in a way. I miss my In-N-Out burger and trip to Amoeba Records, but like it was nice to stay on the East Coast and be a part of this. I always miss this. So
yes, that's more important than the Grammy, being a part of the Grammy press gaggle. It's being a part of the post-game podcast. So we appreciate
this gaggle.
Yes, that's where we are. Okay, we're going to start off talking about Beyonce. Beyonce is now tied for second on the all-time tally of Grammy Award winners. She has 28 Grammys, and on the surface, great, phenomenal, big news. The Beehive's currently furiously Googling Sir Georg Solti to figure out if Solti is going to be winning any additional Grammys or if Beyonce can safely leapfrog him.
And good news, he's not making any more records. So.
That's true. We have been without the services of Sir Solti for at least 2 decades now. So great. Good news, right? Except, okay, most of the Grammys that Beyonce has won have been in genre categories. Beyonce has never won Album of the Year, despite having released incredibly important records. Last night, she won 4 awards, none of them in the main categories again. So we have this tension between, hey, we're fetting Beyonce, who showed up, which was not a given, but also we're up to our old tricks. What did you guys make of the tug of war of the Beyonce spectacle?
I think it's important to point out that not only are most of the Grammys that she has won in the genre categories, all but one. The only major Grammy that she has won is on Single Ladies. She was one of the credited songwriters on that song, and that was 11 years ago. And I mean, since then, she made the Beyonce album that like totally changed the game about releasing music. She made Lemonade.
She's just been Beyonce at the risk of turning this into a complete love fest. Just very straightforwardly, she has been Beyonce. And yet,
the message that it sends is that we somehow don't view you as a major artist. We view you as this artist who makes music for niche audiences. Yeah, sure, your music gets played on R&B radio. Here's a bunch of R&B awards. And even if that's not the decision that they're making step by step every year, the fact that it's accumulated that way, I think is pretty damning about the Grammy votership, what they think, how they view artists, and what they really want to reward.
Last night, Taylor Swift won for Album of the Year for Folklore, third Album of the Year victory, causing a tremendous amount of consternation to a lot of people. Not necessarily people like myself who think Folklore is a fine record, but not a great record, but people who are saying, isn't it odd that Taylor Swift has three Album of the Year wins and Beyonce has zero Album of the Year wins?
There's a screenshot making the rounds on social media this morning from friend of the pod and New York Times contributor Hanif. And he wrote something in his Instagram stories about how Taylor Swift has now won the same amount of Album of the Year Grammys as all Black women throughout all history of popular music, right? The only three Black women to win Album of the Year are Lauryn Hill in 1999, Whitney Houston in 1994, and Natalie Cole in 1992. The last time a Black artist won Album of the Year, we all know, Herbie Hancock doing Joni Mitchell tribute in 2008. To me, this was a Band-Aid Grammys, right? This was, look at all the women we care about. Look at all the Black women we care about. Let's let these rappers have their moment to talk about Black Lives Matter. And all that stuff I thought was super effective, right? Everybody that I just named who got the opportunity, I felt like claimed it. They did a great job with what they were given. But then you see something like, you know, the Taylor win, the Billie win, her gushing over Megan, which we can talk about. But all of that, it's like, it's none of these people's fault. It's just that they see rap specifically and also R&B as seasoning, as you know, it's a token to them still. And I think that we may be easing out of that period finally. This Is America was the first rap song to ever win Song and Record of the Year, right? Like, that was only a couple years ago. I think we're maybe moving in the right direction, but it's slow.
And I imagine if you have been a Grammy Academy member for decades, you know, since the 70s or 80s or even the 90s, you may still be internally grappling with the rise of hip hop and the way in which hip hop has completely remade the center of pop music, to say nothing of the center of country, the center of rock. Like, it seeps into all these other spaces. That may be something that if you've been watching for 30 years, you may perceive as unwelcome, whereas everybody who's lived through it and is living through it sees it as utterly normal. This was maybe the first year of the Grammy Awards where I was watching, at minimum, at least the performances, and thought, ah, this reflects popular music sort of as it is, rather than some older generation determining with very, very severe selectivity which parts of contemporary music are deemed acceptable and palatable.
Well, it was a much better show than it's been in the past. And I think, you know, we know that the show had been under the specific leadership of one producer, Ken Ehrlich, for 30-something years. So this was the first year they tried something new. And this was the first time in, like, probably my lifetime that I can remember no quote-unquote Grammy moments. The idea that, like, in order to craft a memorable, special performance, you have to pair a young person with an old person because a young person...
And a violin.
Yes, but because a young person couldn't possibly be compelling enough on her own. You're going to have to put her with somebody older. Honestly, like, freeing the shackles of that made the show so much more lively. And even though I was petrified of a pandemic Grammys and what it was going to look like, all the other award shows were kind of crappy. I thought that they really pulled it off.
I have to say, I didn't do all the specific math, but when I was writing up my notebook, I did look up the age of every performer. And almost every performer was under 40. Very, very many were under 30. If you had to average it out, I'd say it averaged at around 29, 30, 31, somewhere in there. And that matters, because I just can't recall a Grammy ceremony where that number would have been within 10 years of that. And again, you know, I don't want to be dismissive to people who have been making music for 30 or 40 years and perceive the Grammy as kind of an ongoing validation of the work that they had done earlier or even in the middle part of their career. But it always has been frustrating as a critical exercise to assess the Grammys as anything other than some overwhelming compromise, some weird kind of like stuffing the artists of the now into the conceptions of the then. And this year's show, at least, did not feel that way.
Well, and if you take John Mayer and Chris Martin out of the mix, two totally unnecessary additions to the
completely
show,
gratuitous.
Then that average goes down even further.
John Mayer, his performance on TikTok recently has been more lively than whatever he was doing on the show last night. Cut it out. Trim it. Nope, not necessary. Chris Martin, Joe, I sent you an email.
On three in the morning
last night, because you had tweeted yesterday with the Coldplay album cover and the Jacob Collier album cover, basically being like, I dare you to name what these albums are without looking. And this is embarrassing to admit, but until that moment, which is to say 2 hours after the Grammys concluded, I had not consciously allowed myself to register the fact that Coldplay had been nominated for Album of the Year. And it actually made me so relieved, because I think if I had consciously acknowledged it, I would have been so much more scared of them winning, because it's exactly the kind of thing that would have happened at the Grammys 10 years ago or even 5 years ago.
I had this exact experience over the weekend. And as Ben and Karen know, because I was messaging them about it, I was listening to a lot of this Coldplay album. And it's just baffling. Pedro, can you please just play a little bit of Guns by Coldplay right now? The people have to hear it.
Everybody fast forward 30 seconds.
Who needs education or 1,000 splendid sons? Poor is good for business, cut the forest, they're so dumb. Only save your lookalikes and the other ones. It's the opinion of this board that we need more guns.
This bums out even me. I am a really, really genuine big Coldplay fan who was super offended by John Perellis' piece about them years ago before I came to work at the Times. Love Coldplay.
I really do.
But this album is so bafflingly bad. I can't fathom where it came from and how it got nominated.
First of all, JP a lunacy. Legend. I want to be clear. JP a legend. JP's Coldplay piece. A legend. JP's Coldplay piece worming its way into the head of Chris Martin, who's still thinking about it a decade later. Legendary.
Anyway, is that how you explain this album?
I don't know. I choose not to. I didn't even know this album existed.
We're spending a lot of time on Coldplay, but I will say I literally do not think I would be sitting in this room with you guys right now if I had not been handed that Coldplay article by the father of one of my friends in high school. So it was big for me.
The butterfly effect is
the last
real.
Thing I will say about this Coldplay album is that it features backup vocals from none other than Jacob Collier.
Of course it does.
I knew that's where you were going next.
I mean, it's just, all right. So I think this is telling for the show we saw last night, which is Album of the Year was really diminished, right? They made the whole show around Record of the Year, which pretty cool because we made a whole video about Record of the Year. So that worked out.
What a relief. Yeah, a relief. Even though we I appreciate that you posted the outtakes this morning of the video, but I love the kind of big biff of us just being like, it's not going to happen. Although I just want to say, when you asked at the end of that video who I thought was going to win, I did mention Billy as one of the two options. I just want to put that out there.
And that's in the video. You called it.
No, I know. I'm just reminding people, you know, I'm like Babe Ruth with the bat again, being like, I just did after the home run, coming back to home plate, pointing again and be like,
more,
no, I did
more
that.
Proof that John does not watch sports.
I was going to say it. Thank you.
Wait, did Babe Ruth not do that?
He did it before the hit.
No, I know, but that's what I'm saying. Me doing it on podcast is returning
even
to home plate.
Still, it just doesn't make sense as a metaphor, but let's move on.
Oh my God. That later for y'all. Of the four, so the four categories last year, four big categories, best new artist, song of the year, record of the year, album of the year, all Billie Eilish, a coronation for the young generation's most straightforward singer.
We know right now.
We know. This year, very conspicuous, I thought, each of those awards went to a different person, which certainly seems like someone behind the scenes, and of course, we are purely speculating here, decided to make sure that that problem did not repeat itself. So we have Megan Thee Stallion winning Best New Artist. We have her winning Song of the Year. We have Billy winning Record of the Year. Taylor winning Album of the Year. I want to read something that friend of the pod, Rob Harvilla, wrote in his Grammy recap about her, who he described as, quote, a genuinely striking talent, almost underserved by the Recording Academy's wanton overpraise. And I thought that kind of nailed some of the questions or potential head scratching, especially from people who may not be familiar with her outside of the Grammy ecosystem. Now, you could have unpopular songs that win Grammys. I sort of think that's cool that an unpopular song wins a Grammy. But it does seem, and this was true with the Black Pumas nominations as well, that it's a reminder that the Grammys functions in its own ecosystem.
And her is one of these artists, like the Black Pumas, that, you know, in recent years has come up over and over and over again at the Grammys. You don't see these artists on the charts. You don't even see them really being critically acclaimed widely. But every time Grammy nominations roll around, they're in the mix. Now, there's this idea that the Grammys can sort of put artists that it has special either relationships or fondness for into the mix. And Ben has written about that a bunch, as have many other people. It's not supposed to happen in the top four categories where an artist that was not even on the voter shortlist is inserted here. And yet you just wonder, who is the voter even on this final ballot who is picking both this her song, I Can't Breathe, and Billie Eilish's song for Record of the Year, which is at once maybe the most progressive choice and then the most conservative choice in two different categories. And I just have a hard time imagining who this person is that spread out these top four awards in the way that they came down. It doesn't add up to me.
Ben, can you just briefly explain how voting works for these big four categories and about behind the scenes conversations and, you know, scale tipping and things along those lines?
So there's the voting body of 11,000 or so members of the Academy. They're professional musicians and producers and so forth. They go through and make a first pass and they decide, who do we want to nominate? Then their picks, and I believe there's 20 of them, go to this nomination committee. And that's, I think, about 20 people in a room. Their identities are secret in order to protect them from influence. And they go through the choices of that like shortlist and they whittle it down to 8. And in many of the other categories down the ballot, like in the genre categories, the official rules allow them to pull another name that the voters had not originally selected and say, we think this deserves to get in there. In the general field, in these top categories, they're not allowed to do that. So according to the rules, you know, her is there and Jacob Collier is there in Album of the Year and so forth because they made it into the top 20.
Organically.
Yeah. And then this Star Chamber committee decided that they belong in the top 8. And we don't know who the 12 losers were there, of course. And your question was, who ultimately votes? These top categories, every member of the Academy can vote on it. I think there's a maximum number of awards they can ultimately vote for. And you're supposed to vote in categories that you know something about. But everybody, whether you're pop, jazz, classical, whatever, can vote in these fields.
Now, to Joe's point, there's this question of, is there this abstracted, ideated Grammy voter who votes for both Billie Eilish and also votes for her and also votes for Taylor and also votes for Megan? Maybe I'm almost unpopular in the other direction where, like, I kind of hope that that person does exist. I genuinely do. It's just hard to look at that particular roundup after last year and think, this all happened completely organically without any shenanigans.
But remember that this is a plurality vote with 8 names on the ballot. So like the number of votes you need to get is fairly low. Like you can win with like 15% of the vote. So
Fair point.
When you go, a few years ago, they went from 5 to 8 in these top categories. And so introducing more names into it increases the possibility that the voting can be split, that one name rises a little bit above it. So just like statistically, it's more possible now that you can get kind of oddities where like somebody who maybe might not have even made the ballot a decade ago can now actually win.
It's interesting though, because right in real life, you would have to seek out some of this stuff. You'd have to seek out this Her song, right? Even this Beyonce song, you know, this is a Disney Plus song, essentially. You'd have to seek this song out. There are other songs in the mix, Rockstar or Post Malone or Savage, that you could have just taken in naturally. So I'm wondering if the Grammy voters are ultimately sitting down, listening to these songs once or halfway through and making the call in real time. Because you have to imagine if people are voting on the music that they know from life over the past year, you just don't get this combination of winners.
Although I will say, and this is not about a winner, but about a very nominated act, which is Black Pumas, I thought Chris DeVille, I believe it was over at Stereogum, did a pretty like thorough deep dive into the year in Black Pumas. Because I think for folks like us, maybe we don't watch late night TV. We're not looking at those kinds of performances. That's not relevant to us. But he did a good job, I think, of explaining that Black Pumas had kind of worked this angle really intensely, which maybe ends up explaining at minimum the nominations. Obviously, it didn't earn them any Grammys, right? I don't think they won any Grammys, but at least it got them in the conversation. So it's a reminder that, like, you know, for all our kind of we know what's up of critics and reporters, there are still kind of like freak pachinko plays that get you all the way in.
But I think that a really key thing here about the way the Grammys work is that it's this own little ecosystem that's highly politicized in its way, where there's key managers and people involved in the Recording Academy who are active there. And there are certain artists who tend to kind of filter up for one reason or another. And Her is one who has had a much bigger impact within the Grammys than she has had outside of the Grammys. Now, I don't mean to insult her, like she's been on festivals, like she's a real artist who's making music, but I think it's totally plausible to me that her, let's say it's last summer, you're a Grammy voter, you're on the Grammys website all the time, you're in like chats with other Grammy people, and you find out that Her has a Black Lives Matter song. I think it's totally plausible that that becomes a hit in that world, and that like you and I may not be encountering that song in quite the same way that someone within this ecosystem of the Grammys is probably getting lots and lots of attention drawn to this artist and this song.
And it is an ecosystem. Like, Ben, if I'm not mistaken, like via the Grammy website, like Recording Academy members can like email each other and send each other notes and kind of share links and audio, things like that.
You're saying they got their own clubhouse?
Well, they're not invited to our clubhouse, which we will be having a second one very soon. Just stay tuned.
I think there's stuff like that, but even if there isn't, it's a little social universe in which there's lots of meetings and there's lots of email groups and blah, blah, blah. So like, if you want to be part of that, and I think there's a lot of people who are part of it, partly just for the music, but also because the Grammy organization, the Recording Academy, does all this activism. They're involved in music education and so forth. So there's a lot of people that are just like knee deep in Grammy land. And like, they're finding out about music that's bubbling up in that ecosystem. And it's a different ecosystem from the charts and from the general pop culture universe.
Right. Some people use SoundCloud to break. Some people use TikTok to break. And in a couple of occasions, people use the Grammy.com voter network to break. And yeah, I mean, it's funny. And it's like, it's insane to us as people who are engaging with music out as it's lived in the real world. But if you are older, less in touch, you don't put on contemporary pop or hip hop radio. You don't go on Spotify new music. It may be the actual most vital way to be hit by new music.
The last thing I'll say about this is that if you see a Grammys contender in a major category with a couple clicks, you can usually find someone they're connected to in behind the scenes business who is influential in the Grammys world. I don't want to get too conspiratorial about it, but you mentioned Her. I don't know the current state of her team, but was at least at some point managed by Alicia Keys's early manager. Alicia Keys was obviously a huge Grammy darling early in her career, has hosted the Grammys in recent years. If you look at Jacob Collier, he's a mentee of Quincy Jones, who obviously is the one of the winningest Grammy.
Yeah, tied with Beyonce now.
Tied with Beyonce. There are all kinds of these connections. We don't know exactly how these things work, but I think it feeds into the overall assumption that there's something a little weird going on here, a little clubby. You know, we don't feel like the Grammys are totally above board. And yet, we haven't mentioned The Weeknd here, but we have mentioned Beyonce and Jay-Z, other people who have been stiffed by the Grammys in various ways. And yet there they were showing up. Like, people still in the industry still want to win these awards. They still want to support their artists winning these awards. You know, Jay-Z, he's there to support Beyonce and to support Megan Thee Stallion, who is probably the most valuable asset that his company Roc Nation currently has.
Yeah, we haven't talked about Megan yet, and we should talk about Megan as far as Beyonce goes. So obviously, Beyonce is there, and despite the look of shock on her face when Trevor Noah talked about her breaking the record or tying the record, forgive me, but I do not believe that that was genuine shock. I believe that Beyonce knew.
They called her and they told her to come because something very special might be happening?
Honestly, do I think? Yes, I honestly
do
think
that.
Of
course, no question.
Right, but you know, Grammys are supposed to be secret. Like, those envelopes are sealed, and apparently this year sealed extra tight, given how hard it was for people to open them. you know, we know perfectly well that for other award shows, the notion that the winners are a secret until they are revealed, we know that that's a fallacy. Essentially, we understand that people are tipped off. We understand that people negotiate and say, "I won't show up unless I win such and such an award." This happens at a lot of quote unquote lesser award shows. Do I think that Beyonce was encouraged to attend? Yes. I also think, to Joe's point, Beyonce then chose to attend. She could have said, "The hell with the Grammys. You haven't done right by me. You haven't done right by other artists I care about." But she did choose to attend.
And she didn't give them much, to be fair. She didn't perform, right? And I think this is, it's still a crucial stat. You know, you have the most nominated person at the show not performing. And that happened recently with Kendrick Lamar. It happened recently with Jay-Z. And Jay-Z came right out and said, "F the Grammys," after he went 0-for-8. And yet, you know, he was there for a moment silently. And this, I think, is a good visualization of the sort of push and pull between, do musicians care about the Grammys? Do Black musicians care about the Grammys? And, you know, I think ultimately it's still all we got.
So there's the tension, though, between the Beyonce conundrum and the kind of the new standard, which is Megan, right? So Beyonce's there. She's won her 25th, 26th, 27th, and 28th Grammys, but the Grammys are still not honoring her in major categories, right? But still she shows up, but it's a representation to us of the many flaws of the Grammy process. Here's Megan Thee Stallion, wins Best New Artist, first female rapper to win Best New Artist in a long time. I think maybe 20 years or 25 years, something along those lines.
Since Lauren, right?
Right. Wins two other awards, genre-specific awards, but still wins two other awards for the Beyonce-assisted Savage remix. They're getting in on Megan early, and potentially her Best New Artist win portends bigger things in all genre categories for rappers, for female rappers, for Black women, et cetera, et cetera. That tension is really what the Grammys is grappling right now. How do you kind of reconcile years and years and years of what we've done to Beyonce and others in her position while also trying to like make good for the future? And I was heartened by the relative success that Savage experienced at the Grammys that Megan had, because there's always one or two songs each year that feel completely emblematic of the year that the Grammys just completely biffs for whatever reason. Savage was one of those songs, and I feel like they mostly didn't biff it. I feel like it probably should have won over Billy, but in general, there was a lot of Savage recognition. What did y'all think about how Megan was treated, especially vis-a-vis the long history of Beyonce's treatment?
I think she was treated like a young queen. There's the awards, many of which we don't see because they're given out before the TV show starts. But then there's the TV show. And the artists who are able to accept an award and speak on TV, in a way, it doesn't matter what the award is. That is extremely valuable, and that is the leverage that the Grammys really have is
good
the
point.
TV time.
Yeah, that's a good point.
And so Megan was pictured at least twice, right, making the "Oh my God, it's me" face, and "What am I going to say?" You know, like, so she had one of the like fairy tale kind of moments that the Grammys are able to deliver to an artist. And so I can't imagine she has any complaints at all. Sure, she didn't win Record of the Year, but I feel like any viewer coming away from that show would go, wow, that Megan Thee Stallion, like she really won a bunch of awards. She's like an amazing young woman.
Great performance.
Wow. Great performance. Wow. She's really,
really good. Yeah. Really solid. Like, and also we haven't talked about the Megan performance. Very, very solid Megan performance. And, you know, the Grammys historically terrible with hip rap performances, terrible with women expressing themselves. I mean, it's just like all the things that the Grammys historically bad at, Megan did incredibly, incredibly well at. And that was so heartening to watch, I thought.
I was going to say one other note on her speech was that like she sort of did for the Grammys what they didn't do for themselves. And she gave Beyonce the whole, you know, you're a goddess who inspired my entire career speech, which then Billy did for Megan. So, I think the awards did do a better job this year with that stuff, but the artists did a bit of the heavy lifting themselves.
Yeah, I think there's no question that Megan is like the big winner of last night. She's the spiritual winner of the Grammys. She's what people will remember moving forward. And I think it was a savvy move by the Recording Academy, similar to what they did with Billie last year and what they've done with Adele and what they've done with Taylor, is say like, this person's going to be around a while. Let's put our stamp there. Let's put our arm around them and make sure they're on our side and keep showing up because they're not going anywhere. And I think that, you know, I think that that's necessary and it's savvy. And I'm glad that Megan was able to take such advantage of it. At the same time, you know, you have some of these other guys like DaBaby or Lil Baby or Roddy Ricch that are just as popular as Megan Thee Stallion, got these big performance slots, but you don't really see the Grammys sort of wanting to be chummy with them in the same way. And maybe it goes both ways and those guys are less interested in the same way. But, you know, and you think even back to someone like Kendrick, who got nominated over and over and over again in all these big categories, had these big performances, and then didn't really get the final step of the Grammy stamp. And I think you've seen him sort of slink away. So that's the counterpoint there.
And also, you can't overlook, obviously, the song that Megan won for features Beyonce. And, you know, and that's, again, it's not to take anything away from Megan, but it features Beyonce. DaBaby song does not feature Beyonce. Lil Baby song does not feature Beyonce. I think for Grammy voters who are tentative and don't totally understand hip hop as it's currently experienced, it might be a one click easier to vote for Savage Remix when they see Beyonce's name than it would be to vote for DaBaby, who they probably have not encountered out in real world, which is insane for everybody who listens to podcasts. That's our world. But the Grammy world does not have much overlap with our world. None of us has slept very much. It was music's least slept night. Joe, Ben, Karen, always a pleasure. I hope you guys get to nap now.
Thanks for having us.
Superhero in that Lamborghini like I'm Batman. Something they ain't used to seeing from every black man. Try to bring me down. Eat up the allegations like Pac-Man. She see me now. Don't know which whip to drive when I leave the house. My skin don't look the same, so I get singled out. Right now I'm performing at the Grammys. I'll probably get poked 5-4 leaving out.
Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
This is A.O. Scott. I'm a critic at the New York Times. What I do and what the other critics here do is part of the same project that all of the journalists at the New York Times work on every day, to give you clarity and perspective, and above all, a deeper understanding of the world. When you subscribe to the New York Times, it's not just here are the headlines, but here's the way everything fits together. If you'd like to subscribe, please go to nytimes.com/subscribe.
We're now in part two of the Grammy cast. John Perales, chief pop music critic of the New York Times, is here. JP.
I'm here.
Lindsay Zolads is here. Game live blog compatriot. Just like it was 2010, we were live blogging last night, Lindsay.
We brought blogging back.
I do want to say, you know, I know the New York Times is very focused on a live strategy. I will say, as someone who has not live blogged in a long time, it's hard to like watch the show and live blog at the same time.
That's what commercials
I
are
would,
for.
I would concur.
Yeah, just like I want to underscore like a potential flaw in the strategy. Just throwing that out there if anybody is listening who has any kind of clout in that direction. So in the first half of the episode, we talked a lot about the major awards, about Megan and Billy and Taylor and so on and so forth. We didn't really get into the performances that much. And I have to say up front, I largely enjoyed the Grammys. I largely enjoyed the performances. I felt like I sometimes feel when I'm watching like the BET Awards or the VMAs where I'm like, oh, this is a fun, exuberant performance of a song I have recently enjoyed in a very public context. That doesn't happen that much on the Grammys. So that made me happy. JP, what was your vibe?
I liked it too. I had a good time. I mean, there was some wacky, inexplicable stuff, but that's fine. I thought the little baby segment was astonishing, as good as the Kendrick Lamar opening of some years
ago. Low-key better.
Just like right in your face. And I enjoyed just about everything. I mean, you know, except for John Mayer making guitar star faces, I thought we were doing fine.
You mean the women of country do not need to be validated by the addition, the insertion of a John Mayer solo? Is that what you're trying to communicate to me?
Yeah, more or less.
Lindsay, what about you?
Well, brought a bucket and a mop for this conversation, I would say. Am I allowed
bleep,
to say that on CBS?
Bleep. Also, the dangly thing, that also got bleeped.
Yeah, shout out to the little dangly thing in the back of the throat.
What is it called? What is it called? Doesn't it have a name?
I think it's a uvula. Is that correct?
I don't know. We're going to Google it, though.
Or is that another word I can't say on CBS? Who knows? But
did they really bleep bucket? I thought I heard bucket.
Well, I just watched the performance again. Cardi does not say bucket. She does say mop, but someone pointed out to me on Twitter that she may have just dropped that line and there was no backing track, which seemed to happen a couple times during the performance, but it did not detract any of the charm for me.
Fair.
I thought.
And yes, it is looking like uvula, just FYI,
okay,
which is
good.
I'm
glad that doesn't mean like something else.
Yes, no. And that is not a censored word on Popcast.
Okay. Good to know for future. I thought WAP was triumphant and clearly billed as the centerpiece of the whole show. I don't know. I didn't crunch the numbers on the airtime, but it felt like Megan's performance, by and large, was the centerpiece, was the main event, and somehow was broadcast live in primetime on CBS of all three of the networks left. Like, gotta love it. Would have killed to have been a fly on the wall. And like, if there's still like a switchboard where people call to complain about things, like would love the audio transcripts of some of that. But, you know, I think by and large, I agree with you guys. I am surprised to say I had a fun time watching the Grammys, more or less. And I do think there was something to be said about this being a year where we were starved for live performances in real life, at least. And I think there was something really satisfying about how performance-based the telecast was. The awards felt almost incidental at times. I think there were a few big wins, such as Megan's and Beyonce's, which we'll get to, that did feel like events in and of themselves. But I felt like the show was based around performances, and I did not mind that, since we haven't really gotten a chance to see as much live music as we may have wanted to this year. So I thought that was a wise decision on their part to really spotlight that. I thought for the most part the staging worked really well. It was kind of fun to see that kind of battle of the bands configuration of just everybody, you know, sitting around watching each other's performances. Bad Bunny just sing along to Dua Lipa, et cetera. Harry Styles and Billie Eilish, like exchanging just
vibes.
Like game recognized game glances. And so, yeah, I have my quibbles, which we'll get to, but by and large, above average Grammys.
I would have liked to have seen that conceit, the kind of Jules Holland conceit, carried through the show. I understand it was like a way to kind of get into the performances, and then some of the bigger, clearly either pre-taped or very, very ornate performances could not fit into that context. But I liked it. It made that first hour of the broadcast feel intimate, small, convivial, about really a group of people all with a common purpose, including like the stagehands, who you could see dancing kind of in between the stages, like off in the back of the screen, you know, very much a kind of like we're all in this together energy. And also I thought for Black Pumas, a band that doesn't do a terrible amount for me, just to put them like kind of on the same platform as Harry Styles, as Billie Eilish, and almost like just like to force them to watch Black Pumas was, I thought, probably the best thing that could happen for Black Pumas, short of like an upset victory in one of the major categories.
Just dead silence. No one wants to talk about Black Pumas.
Wow. Okay. No, well, moving on then in that case. But later in the show, very ornate performances from BTS, Megan and Cardi, Doja Cat. We really didn't talk about Doja Cat at all. Doja Cat sort of like untethering the Grammys from the Grammy stage, untethering the Grammys from Grammy moments, allowed for people to kind of like let their full freak flag fly, whatever that might mean. And, you know, it means something very different for BTS than it does for Doja Cat. But it created a tremendous amount of opportunity to experience Dua Lipa, for sure, to experience pop kind of like closer to its like native environment than kind of like, how do we awkwardly fit this onto a stage with Yo-Yo Ma?
I think perhaps why a lot of these performers, like a Dua Lipa, really brought their A game to this is they couldn't tour this material by it for the most part. Like, their sort of ambitions for live music this year were also thwarted. So much in the way that like Lady Gaga basically used this year's VMAs to do the Chromatica tour as she had envisioned it, I think you did get some artists like Dua Lipa, like Megan and Cardi to some extent, not that they were going to tour together, but there, I think there just was both on our end, like a desire to see that big spectacle, but these artists really wanted to put on a show too. I think even Taylor's performance, which as I've said, was not my favorite, there still was something about the staging that she went all out. Like all the ideas that any of these artists had for live staging of this new material that came out this year, this was kind of the only outlet they were, or at least the biggest outlet they were going to get this year to really pull that off. And I agree. I think Dua Lipa probably was the one that made the most of that. Like, it did feel like going to the Future Nostalgia tour for 5 minutes, and it was very transportive and just really impressive. Like, she hit all the marks and
most of the marks. Most of the marks. Jeremy O'Harris on Twitter, I believe, called her a rhythmless icon in an affectionate way, and I felt that.
I'll allow it.
JP, were there any performances that stood out to you, struck you as being better than anticipated, anything along those lines?
Well, Haim's performance was basement band on the floor, but I thought it was really moving. I thought they really made you feel that song. And that was like total simplicity, though I still don't know where the slide guitar came from. Somebody in the back was playing slide guitar. I thought Mickey Guyton used her 5 minutes really beautifully. She was statuesque. She sang beautifully. The choir came in at the right moment when you weren't expecting them. And she really delivered that song.
It's a hard life on easy street. Just one painted picket fence as far as you can see. In the land of the free, you should try to be your black like me.
So the thing about Mickey Guyton, and I feel like it's like you can't emphasize this enough, like Mickey Guyton has been signed to a major label in Nashville for almost a decade, maybe a decade. I wrote about her first Nashville major label single. I mean, we're talking 2012, maybe 2013. It was a long, long ass time ago. Still has not released a full length record, has only released a handful of songs since then, in kind of what can only start to feel like a deliberate silencing or putting in the corner of a very talented singer. The thing about Black Like Me as a song, which from what I can gather has garnered zero support of country radio, it's a very well-written country song. Like, this is the thing. Like, if you're going to do measurements
of what's a good country song. If you're going to measure it by subject matter, if you're going to measure it by songwriting structures, if you're going to measure it by vocal talent, by all those measures, it's an excellent country song. And yet, doesn't really do anything within the contemporary country music industry. In that way, it's nice to see the Grammys doing a bit of forward-thinking advocacy work by giving Mickey Guyton this kind of platform.
What is the label that signed her waiting for?
I mean, I don't know. If anybody works for that label and would like to share some information with me, my DMs are open. You can email me at podcast@nytimes.com. I'd love to hear more, to be quite honest. Because I feel like even compared to, and again, it's like not a totally fair comparison, but, you know, she performed right before Miranda, right before Maren. And of the three, I thought hers was the most impressive performance. And if you're sitting on some Mickey Guyton music, now's the time to start thinking about doing something with it. That's how I feel.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about the Grammys performances, too, is that they give the performer a chance to connect with an audience who's never going to hear them otherwise. And if you do a stellar performance like that, like Adele did, like Brandi Carlile did, it's a good thing to capitalize on Mickey Guyton's label.
Right. And the sort of ongoing resistance. I mean, you know, there's been a tremendous amount of discourse lately about Black performers in country, Black women in country, country music self-conceptualization as a genre of white interests, white social concerns. Keeping Mickey Guyton basically on the bench tells me that you're not interested in the concerns of what it's like to be Black in the country music industry, what it's like to be a Black woman in the country music industry. And as a industry, that's something that those folks should be reckoning with. It's like if you're going into office every day thinking about that and not doing something about it, you're not doing the right thing. That's how it feels to me.
Well, plus, you know, there's money to be made.
Sure. You know, let's be cynical about it.
If you sell some records, I thought that's your job. You know.
Deep sigh. Deep sigh. Can we talk briefly about Silk Sonic? JP.
It's the Grammy Museum. It's the Grammy Museum.
Yes, right. But this is the thing. So the Grammys. But look, I think we've moved, I hope, beyond the point in the Grammys where like 75% of the newer artists are Silk Sonic-esque, which is to say young or youngish musicians performing in old time-tested styles. Bruno's got a lovely voice. And I did think this song's really effective, but it just, it kind of almost felt out of place in a Grammys that also featured The Baby, Lil Baby, Megan, Cardi, Dua. This felt like a little bit of like, a little bit of that old sauce, just a tiny bit of that old sauce.
I think that there were moments that sort of put the moments of progress into relief that reminded you you were watching the Grammys. And that performance definitely felt like one. I think the Black Pumas performance also. And then Billie Eilish's win at the end, which we can get to and unpack the many layers of that, or just not talk about it too. Fine with that. But yeah, it kind of, I think you almost needed moments like that to appreciate the lack of them in the rest of the show, if that makes sense. That it, I do think there was a certain amount of progress and reason to be more hopeful about the Grammy future. But then every time you would feel that, there would be this moment to kind of pull you back and be like, well, we're still watching the Grammys. Never forget.
What were some of those, besides the Billie Eilish thing, what were some of the moments that made you feel that way?
John Mayer. Just yes. Being there. I think like the reason I'm being a little hard on Taylor Swift's performance was I wanted her to just do an impromptu Dear John, like grab the, see that he's there and just go in.
Taylor, very generous to Harry. Worth mentioning, when Harry won early in the night, Taylor jumped up for standing ovation, maybe the first person. Although, you know, hey, I'm just saying, maybe she jumped up to take some air, take a few steps. I don't know. Just speculating, could go either way. But, you know, it was widely discussed online that she was the first person to jump up for Harry.
There's also like the Grammy Zapruder film online of like the minute long conversation that she and Harry had with each other during the commercial break.
I didn't see that.
My favorite part is that Aaron Dessner is standing right between them the whole time. So the only person who knows what was said between Taylor Swift and Harry Styles is Aaron Dessner of The National, which is not something I had, you know, 5 years ago on my bingo card. But
Were they masked, or can we put a lip reader on it?
They are unmasked, but she's not facing the... We're going to get the lip read expert in here. So if any lip readers...
Future Daily Mail headline, Taylor Swift, : my ex Harry gave me COVID, ... but it's okay.
Oh, let's then hope not.
Subhead, Joe Alwyn hospitalized.
Oh, I'm just going to leave that right there. That's all you.
Sorry. I'll go on private. My bad. Do you feel like this version of the Grammys, which is to say, not all on one stage, youth-focused, loose... There's been disagreement amongst us on whether Trevor Noah was good or bad, but this kind of like friskier, livelier, mixed up Grammys, is this a template for future years, or is this a, whew, we got through it, thank God, and now let's just get back to normal? What do y'all think?
I think B. I mean, the Staples Center was built for the Grammys, basically, to their specifications. I can't imagine them not going back to use it. It would be nice if they learned something. But you pointed out in your great piece, John, about the age range of the participants and how few older folks there were. I think once they can go back indoors, I think they'll be back. But also there's a new producer this year. It's a generational change.
Maybe that gives me hope. Although, okay, this is going to be a big shock for all parties involved. But let me devil's advocate for a second. Okay? I want you to, here's a thought exercise.
You've never done this before.
Never, not once.
A little shocked.
But you're going to be shocked at the specifics of this devil's advocacy. Hot take, the Grammys are the only award show left that genuinely honors older generation musicians in a consistent way, and we lose something when they are not on stage, even if it's in an awkward way. I don't know if I agree with this. I'm just throwing it out there as an idea. What do y'all think about that, having come off of a Grammys that basically ignored everybody over 40?
I'm with you guys that I wonder, as bleak as it sounds, like how much of that was a COVID health concern, and not to go there, but bringing up the Charlie Pride situation from the CMAs, like where how much of that was an intentional decision of the content of the show and how much was like a legal liability. I don't think we're going to actually know the answer to that.
And also on top of that, how much of that are musicians who are in their 50s, 60s, and 70s being like, hell no.
Yeah.
I'm not coming to your show. You kidding me? You want me to come and like play viola with the baby? No, I'm not going to do that.
Shout out to the viola player.
Shout out to the viola player. Who is, I believe, under 40. But you know what I mean? Like, I don't know what part of it was self-preservation, what part of it was legal concern, what part of it was a radical new approach to the Grammys. JP, I'm actually kind of cautiously optimistic it's the other way, which is now that we broke the template, we don't have to go back to it. But it did make me think, maybe we're missing a little continuity. Like, how far away are we from Taylor Swift being too old to be on the Grammys? You know, a year?
There was a Grammy moment in the Little Baby segment when you had Killer Mike, a venerable 45 years old, joining in for a verse. It's like the elder generation and the young whippersnappers. I mean, but for the Grammy moment to be in the middle of a fist-pumping hip-hop song, you know, with burning buildings, was pretty impressive.
What do you think, Lindsay? Like, do you find yourself crying out for the boomers to show up?
Always. That's where I come from constitutionally in every aspect. I guess I hadn't really noticed that. And I am kind of like thinking it through now, but it is making sense. Like, we have to talk about Beyonce for multiple reasons, but I do think she was almost treated as like the elder stateswoman in the room. And she is still under 40 and is Beyonce, like still very much in the current pop conversation. I think that is helping me sort of understand why the tone of her presence and the Trevor Noah's reactions to her just felt a little off to me. Like, I think they were almost treating her like she was one of the legacy acts when I think she still very much sees herself in the mix, and a lot of people also do. But there was this, I mean, I loved the sort of intergenerational moment between her and Megan Thee Stallion when they were accepting for Savage. And it just felt, Megan's reaction in particular was just so effusive and genuine, and saying that she had grown up like wanting to be the rap Beyonce. And Beyonce's presence of sort of hanging back and letting Megan take the mic and say a lot more than Beyonce had to say, like, that felt like a moment. And I think that song in and of itself, like, that is kind of the meta text of that song, of it feels like a baton passing in a way. Not that they are very similar artists, they make really different kinds of music, but there's something to Beyonce giving Megan that cosign and now winning a Grammy for their collaboration that feels somehow like just a generational movement into, not, again, not that Beyonce is particularly old or out of the conversation in any way, but something was going on there. And I think maybe the show was like missing that kind of legacy act and the presence of someone whose very attendance of the show kind of solidifies it in that way. So they were really doubling down on her.
And also, I mean, it's the unspoken part of that is, we have to be nice to Beyonce because, number one, we don't know if she's going to show up even to win these record-breaking awards. We don't know if she's going to show up, number one. Number two, we've done her dirty for years now. So, and also, like, she and Jay, from what I can gather, didn't show up on time and left early. So it's like, while she's here, we're going to be nice as possible.
Their timing for just appearing and leaving certain places is impeccable. Just,
yeah, really, so really solid.
They know how to make an impression.
JP, did you miss the boomers at all? I got to be honest, when I saw Ringo show up at the end, I was shocked, because it really just felt like a dive bomb from a totally different award show.
I like people who can still perform. The Grammys have always made me kind of sad when, you know, you have some grizzled boomer reprising their hit next to some 20-something who just learned it at the rehearsal. Neither of them is into it. Neither of them is giving the beloved song what it deserves. If boomers can perform, I'd be happy to see them in the mix. I don't think you should have a maximum retirement age from the Grammys. But on the other hand, it was nice to not have that weight of, we must uphold the tradition, on the stage.
But that brings up for me the fundamental philosophical question, which I kind of didn't get into in my piece, but has been on my mind over the last couple hours as I've been thinking about it, which is, what function does the Grammy serve? Does the Grammy serve as a document and record and judgment upon the music of the now? Or is it an umbrella idea about the long legacy of pop music history, you know, many decades of pop music history, and the way that they interface with each other, either awkwardly or seamlessly? I feel like if you had asked me in any other year prior to this year, I would have said it's the latter, and that sucks. I don't like it, but it's what it is. This year, I think not. And for at least a person like me that pays a lot of attention and cares about these things, I'm kind of relieved. JP, you've been watching the Grammys for decades.
I know, it's a terrifying thing.
But has there ever been a spell, a year, or a time stretch where the Grammys have felt 100% tapped in to the immediate now, like this year's episode did?
In a word, never. They've always been the older generation vaguely tolerating the younger generation. It's like, you kids may be paying our executive perks at the record companies, but we like our old-fashioned stuff. I mean, when they started throwing Tony Bennett in the face of the MTV generation, you know, it's what they had always done.
A Grammy psyop, if ever there were one.
They're never going to be contemporary because you have this drag of existing members. You have to have, I think, 6 or 7 credits on albums to be able to join. So there's always... It's like the infection lag in COVID. You know?
Oh, ooh, I'm not going to top that.
Before we go.
But hey, we did have Chris Martin on piano. You know, we did have John Mayer on guitar.
I don't know who he is. I'm unfamiliar with his music. Before we go, there's so many categories that we obviously don't have time to get into, but I wonder if there was any down ballot stuff that kind of jumped out at you as being a good win, a notable win, a kind of like encouraging win.
Fiona Apple winning two awards, one for her album and one for the song Shamika, is a good thing, a net positive in the world, but also I found her decision and her explanation of why she was not attending to be quite poignant and kind of the perhaps the most powerful quote unquote protest of the award show. And
can you describe it a little bit? Because she put a video out on Instagram.
She announced, via her friend's Instagram the morning of the show that essentially she said, look, I have problems with the Grammys, the way that the voting goes, et cetera. But the main reason that she did not want to attend was she is sober now. And she said the strain of being on national television and people comparing me to other artists and going through with all the pageantry would be like a threat to my sobriety, basically. And so that's why I'm not going. And I thought that was just so commendably honest and not the way celebrities usually talk about these sorts of things. Like it just, much like that record, it felt like the result of just a lot of like personal wisdom and things she had gone through and coming out the other side is with just a clarity about herself that something about that was very refreshing. And she's always been using, or more recently has been using, her platform to kind of address a lot of activist causes and said like, yeah, the Grammys are unfair, but you know, it's really unfair. The court system, like
big pivot, go check big pivot out. In the video,
yes, which I guess, in his own way, DaBaby was trying to maybe say that with his performance too. And I still don't know why there were people in judge robes.
But were those judge robes? Thing. I guess I thought they were kind of like church choir robes. Were they judge robes? Maybe they were.
I think they looked, God. I yeah. don't know. I Fair still point. Am quite Fair confused point. By that performance. But anyway, but I thought, you know, there were a variety of different kind of philosophical strains of protest. And, you know, obviously The Weeknd saying what he said, Zayn also coming out against the Grammys, and with this sort of feeling that giving sense that the Grammys still matter enough for them to protest them, I guess, if that makes sense, that to protest them in that way is still buying into the idea that the Grammys are honoring the best music of the year. And I think I am more interested in artists like Fiona or like Frank Ocean in years past that have just kind of opted out of the whole thing and said, like, I don't even care enough about this to take it seriously. Like, here's another cause that is more worth your time. And so in a year where we were having discussions about what it meant to attend, what it meant to buy into the pageantry, I think both the fact that Fiona won two awards, which were very deserved, I still think that was the best record of last year, and her clear-eyed logic of not attending were both just really refreshing to me.
JP, what about you? Down ballot excitement.
In the hip-hop categories, they finally gave Nas a Grammy.
We've just complained about the Grammys for so many years, giving just basically like the elder in a category the Grammy, just because like the most people know who that person is. Most voters know who that person is. And I'm so glad that hip hop is mature enough of a genre that we have now arrived at the point where Nas just wins the Grammy for a record that is not an essential Nas record and is probably, and I, you know, forgive me for not having given that Nas record a lot of time, but is certainly not the best record in that category, but he is the best known person. So congratulations to hip hop. We made it. For me, the Fiona ones were big for me. I was happy to see Bad Bunny win in Best Latin Pop or Urban Album. Was amused to see Kanye win in Best Contemporary Christian Music Album, which is notable that he's not in the Best Gospel category. There is a split there. It's notable that he's in that category. I was surprised to see him win. Billy Strings in Best Bluegrass. And I think I want to go out with a very, 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 very
down ballot winner. So let me wrap things up. John Perales, Lindsay Zolads, thank you so much. Thank you earlier to Joe Coscarelli, Karen Gans, Ben Cesario. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get in the Facebook group. We'll do another Clubhouse chat. Email us at podcast@nytimes.com. I think I saw that Sam started a Discord. I still don't know how to use Discord, but I guess jump in the Discord and I'll figure it out. Subscribe to podcast anywhere you get your audio content, Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, et cetera, et cetera. Our producer today and every day on quick turnaround on Grammy Day, it's Pedro Rosado from Head Stepper Media. So let's go out with the deep, 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 deep down ballot victor, the best remixed recording, also the best song not named Savage Remix. That was also a major TikTok trend last year. Let's get it in with Rose's Iman Beck Remix by St. John.
The living room is where you make life's most beautiful memories. But your sofa shouldn't be the one remembering them. The new life-resistant, high-performance furniture collection from Ashley is designed to withstand all the spills, slip-ups, and muddy paws that come with the best parts of life. Ashley high-performance sofas and recliners are soft, on-trend, and easy to clean. Shop the high-performance furniture in-store or online at ashley.com. Ashley, for the love of home.